Now we come to chapter 4. Now, let me ask you this. It's not a complicated chapter. Are there questions that you want to raise about Hume and Voltaire and natural law, philosophy, determinism, and freedom? there's a statement I want to bring to your attention at the bottom of 73, and that is John Howell's statement, his main character in modern school thought. He insisted that the liberalism of the Enlightenment was really an effort to bring about a compromise between two conflicting principles, the absolute value of human person on the one hand, and the eternal universal law of nature on the other. Now, do you see the implication and the thrust of that statement? The problem is this, that once you elevate natural law, or the law of nature, and impersonal nature, to the supremacy in human life, how do you maintain the concept, as he put it, of the absolute value of human personality? In other words, what is the origin of personality? And in a sense, Dan, this arises out of the question you raised. How can impersonal nature, through evolution or some other concept of natural law, produce personality? Yes, it is. And it's a very good point, a very valid point. Because the advocates of natural law, the humanists, cannot answer the question. And that's by definition, it can't. The impersonal cannot produce the personal. Impersonality cannot give birth to personality. If there's no soul, then a no-soul being cannot produce a being with soul, Dan. That's right.
This was really a much wider issue, wasn't it, than that, just between liberalism and enlightenment, than the whole great overriding question of modern times.
Yes, that's correct. But you see, have you ever read John Howell's main current in modern thought? Well, he would insist, he was merely depicting here the Enlightenment, but his whole thrust of that book, it's a very good book, by the way, is toward that end, that the history of modern political thought emanating from the Enlightenment has been the degradation of human personality. You see, the older rationalists, however wrong they were, did not deny the existence of soul. And even Descartes, with all his problems, or even Leibniz, had some accommodation for soul by some appeal to theology. Newton did not. I forget. I thought I had a footnote in Newton here somewhere, but maybe I didn't. Yes. Just one little footnote on page 70, which limits the implications of Newton's position. I have a footnote here again from Newton, from Howell. But when the Christian conscience is separated from the church and progressively divorced from revelation, it degenerates into a mere cult of sentiment and loses its value. Now, this is Howell, and this is my position, this is Van Til's position. I don't mean that Howell was a devotee of Van Til. That would not be accurate. Not because he would necessarily oppose him, but because I don't believe they had ever had, I don't believe Howell, when he had written this book, was aware of too much of Van Til. The book was published in 1950, and Radcliffe is, 31 years ago, and I don't think he ever read Van Til. Now, the liberal effort to force the fences between these two irreconcilable principles cometh in an age which was worshiping science could only push the doctrine of soul of man as a source of his personality further in the background. That's my quote in 74. But note, the quote from Lemaître. One must grant me only that organized matter is endowed with a principle of motion which alone differentiates from the matter that has no organization at all, and that all animal life depends on the diversity of this organization. Now, this is Lemaître, an 18th century writer. In other words, the difference between you and a cow, or me and a muskrat, or all of us and a monkey, is due to the difference of the organization of the atoms in our makeup. Now, the Greeks held this view. If you go back to Heraclitus and some of those men, they held the concept of fire atoms, and they defined the soul as that material aspect of the body which was composed of fire atoms, over against the atoms which were, you remember that, Harry, which were not fire atoms. In other words, simply a degree of difference in the atomic structure, to put it in modern language. That's the only difference between us and the animals. Now,
if you held a position like that in the monastery, that when science says that there was no difference in the atoms,
the
same, then your whole theory collapses.
Yeah, then,
say there was no difference.
That's in your soul classes too. It was based upon an assumption of difference that science could prove did not exist. And Emily, of course, with her scientific training, is well aware of that. Now, without going to all that, Combilocke, these are the philosophes. Now, on the men, I'm Helvetius, Combilocke, and so on. These are the so-called philosophes. Now, who were the philosophes? Harry, don't answer, because you know. They were the philosophic forerunners of the French Revolution. They were the 18th century materialistic philosophers who provided the philosophic defense and inspiration for the French Revolution. If you know Helvetius, Claude Helvetius, 1571, he took the Enlightenment even further toward the ultimate goal. And in his Of the Mind, he developed not only Christian theology, but Christian morality as well. Now, you say he was an advance of his time. There's a very interesting book I mentioned down at the bottom of 73 in a footnote. The Heavenly City of the 18th Century Philosophers. Originally published in 1932, 50 years ago, by Carl Becker, who was a professor of modern history at Cornell University for many years. And he was a great exponent of the optimistic liberalism of the first half of the 20th century. And he went back into history to prove that point. And the book which received, the most acclaim of all his writings was this book. At about 1941 or two, he wrote a book called How Better Will the New World Be? which was an attempt to portray the New Deal as a solution to all human problems. But before his death, he wrote a book called Modern Democracy, in which he displayed absolute pessimism as to the hope of the Western world. All his hopes had crushed, had been crashed around. He'd been crushed. And it was a dramatic change. He had a contemporary by the name of Charles Beard, who brought out his famous phrase, economic interpretation of the Constitution and his economic interpretation of Jeffersonian democracy, in which he held in both books that economics played a key role in in American affairs. And he wrote money.
Did you say
he
played a major role, a major influence?
Yes, that's what I meant to say. And he was very optimistic. But he finally came to a place where history for him had no meaning. And in his last book, which received violent attacks, which he wrote in 1947, it was called President Roosevelt and the Coming of War, in which he turned his back on the New Deal, he turned his back on Roosevelt, and somehow I've never been able to find out how he got a hold of the Pearl Harbor documents, some of which, on which I've been working, and to this day I don't know how he did it, but he got a hold of them, and he got a hold of some other material, which was hush hush secret material, and he put it in a book. And because he had such a name, he sent it to the Yale University Press, and the Yale University man told him this was too hot to handle at first, and then he sent it to the representative of the company in Boston. Anyway, they wouldn't touch it. And so finally, he went back to the manager of the press at Yale, where he'd been publishing his work, and the Yale man said, yes, we'll publish it, but you have got to lift the last chapter, take it out. And so he agreed to do it. Now, how do I know this? I had dinner with Samuel Fly Bemis one time, who was probably the greatest scholar in American diplomatic history we've ever had. He wrote a series of volumes called The American Secretary of State. He wrote a great book on John Quincy Adams, Secretary of State. He wrote a series of books, the Jay Treaty, the Pinckney Treaty, and was a thoroughgoing scholar at Yale. And I had dinner with him, and somebody was talking about American foreign policy. I don't remember who it was. And he and I got talking. And he said, are you familiar with Beard's book? I said, I certainly am. I said, well, I'm going to tell you something about that book. He said, I have the last chapter. Before Beard died, he gave the last chapter in custody to Samuel Flagg Bemis. And I remember the same address, the speaker was talking about Roosevelt foreign policy. And Bemis shouted out in the middle of the meeting. He says, what foreign policy? May you tell me?
You mean Beard, Becker?
No, I mean Beard. Beard wrote the President Roosevelt in the Coming of War. And it was a book which repudiated, he brought what he called the devil theory of war, and he implied that the devil was living in person, and that Mr. Roosevelt was the devil of whom he was speaking. he didn't become a Christian, but he turned his back on the whole movement and died in utter despair. And this book was his, today it's well received because so much has come out. Not that I know of. Samuel Flagg Bemis died, and I do not know what happened to that last chapter. I've never seen it in print, and I don't know what was in it. All I know is what Bemis told me, that it was hot material, and it was Houghton Mifflin, a man who with whom I was dealing for publication. He came to see me, and he told me that they couldn't handle Bemis's book, I mean the Beard's book, because it was so hot, the last part. At the time, I don't know how Beard escaped it. See, when I saw the Pearl Harbor document, we were told that if we revealed anything we saw, we would have a $10,000 fine and 10 years in prison in the federal penitentiary in Atlanta, or the government's counterpart to what then was the famous Henry Grady Hotel.
The one blew up here a while back.
Yeah.
Well,
that was one of the topics I traced down. There were five basic reasons. One of them was that in 37 and 38, we had a very, very serious economic depression, much worse than the one of 29.
Absolutely. I remember it.
The whole bottom dropped out.
Which year, 37?
Yes, in the fall of 37. No, the stock market didn't go down as much because it couldn't. It wasn't a place to get up it up. But the economic indicators, the bottom dropped out. GM, Ford, General Electric, all the big companies were in trouble, dire trouble. And unemployment was higher than it had been. The New Deal had failed. And people were beginning to realize that the New Deal was a failure. In 1938, this was one reason he got in the war for economic recovery. The second reason was in 1938, and Harry will remember this. In 1937, when he was supposedly at the top of his glory, he brought in the Supreme Court Reform Bill. And he thought he could ram it through the Congress, or the Senate. Yeah, well, Senator George of Georgia, whom we knew real well, and Senator Cotton Ed Smith of South Carolina, Senator Gillette of Iowa, Senator Van Nuys of Indiana, and Senator Johnson of Colorado, Carter Glantz of Virginia, the senior Harry Byrd of Virginia, and Josiah Josh Bailey of North Carolina, Senator Anders of Florida, and others organized, Senator Pat Harris of Mississippi, organized, Senator Russell of Georgia, organized the group around which other senators clustered, and that defeated the bill. Now, this was a crushing defeat for Roosevelt. He'd never been so publicly stomped. The bill never even... the Senate committee brought an adverse report. And Senator McCarran, the man with whom I worked later, was chairman of the committee. On 11-8 vote, the committee said, don't bring the bill in. It's a bad bill. Well, Roosevelt insisted that the bill be introduced in the Senate in spite of the adverse report in the committee. Well, when you get an adverse report in the Senate of a committee bill, you're in trouble. But Roosevelt would not listen to his advisors, and when the bill was brought in, it lost by about, I think it was 87-12, something. I mean, it wasn't even close. It was overwhelmingly defeated. And in the debate, Senator Pat Harrison of Mississippi got so mad he dropped dead. And there was a senator from New York.
Physically?
Uh-huh.
Because of anger?
Yes. There was a senator from New York. I'm trying to remember his name. He was a physician. And he got one day and told his colleagues not to get so angry, that it was bad for him. He dropped dead in the Florida Senate. And another man, three men dropped dead in the Florida Senate. The thing was hot. And in 1938, as a result of that, Roosevelt decided to purge the Senate of George, Smith, Bailey, Gillette, Van Nuys, Johnson, and a couple of other senators, Andrews of Florida. Well, in the primaries, every one of those senators was renominated. My father and I we knew Senator George, so down at Barnesville, Roosevelt in the summer, about August, went down and gave a speech against Senator George. But as he hobbled across the platform, he put his hand on George's shoulder and said, God bless you, Walter. Sheer hypocrisy. But when the election took place on September 28, 1938, at the time the Georgia primary at that time, Walter George won the largest primary vote in Georgia history. They had a young lawyer by the name of, what was it, Carlisle from, maybe, I guess it was. Anyway, I asked a lawyer in town one day what had happened to Camp, and he said, who was Camp? Well, Camp got less than 100,000 votes. and George, he didn't defeat him. It was a massacre. I mean, it was pathetic. Camp might have been all right, didn't have much sense, running against Walter George. the other fellow was Senator Bohr from Idaho, the great Republican. And when George, Senator Roosevelt picked a man to run against Bohr, and the fellow, his name was Clark, and the fellow from Idaho looked the ground over, and he wrote back to Mr. Roosevelt, he says, if you want to run against Senator Bohr, come up here and do it. And he backed out of the election because he... Well, he was a tremendous orator, and at times was unpredictable. They say at one time, when Cooley was having breakfast in the White House, he looked out, and Bohr was a great horseman. Of course, from Idaho, all he did was ride a horse, and he looked out on Pennsylvania, and Bohr was on the horse going up toward the Rock Creek Park, and Cooley turned to his friend and says, look, he says, there go Bohr and the horse, they're both going the same direction. But Bohr was a terrific opponent, and when you got him against it, you were in real trouble, and Roosevelt was in real trouble. Well, he decided he would purge the Senate of all these reactionaries, so called, and Andrews was reelected, Byrd was reelected. I was in the Union Station at Washington the day that Senator Cotton Ed Smith was renominated. And he happened to come in to the little, there used to be a little restaurant, Union Station, where everybody went for breakfast, started everybody, and he sat down next to me, and since I lived in South Carolina, he knew me, and he took his hand. I said, "Congratulations, Dad, on winning." He took his hand and hit me so hard in the back, it jarred every bone in me. I never thought the man had that much strength. He says, "We beat him, didn't we?" Bang! I got to say, "Yeah, but you defeated me." he was so enthusiastic.
Well, now about the war, then. How
do
you think
how
this led towards the war?
Well, politically, Roosevelt, after that, you see, when the election was held in 1938, all these men came back to Senate. Every one of them. And in that election, the Republicans, who had only 17 senators left in the Senate after the 36 defeat, doubled their membership in the Senate. But in the House, they got something like 185 members, which stunned Roosevelt, because this was the birth of the Dixiecrat Republican coalition. So that from that moment on, George and Russell and Byrd and Carter Glass were in control of the Senate. And nothing got through that they didn't approve of. and the House, there were a great many conservative Democrats in the House from the South who lined up with the Republican leadership. And while the Democrats controlled the House, Roosevelt didn't. Roosevelt's opponents in the House gained the upper hand. And the result was that Roosevelt was a dead duck politically, and he knew it. And a fellow by the name of Gordon Cowell in the American Mercury came out with a very famous prophecy that I can paraphrase, as people in the theater knew when they know they need a new center of attention to divert attention from bad plays. He said, "Roosevelt, as an actor, will come out with a new center of attention." And that was exactly right, because in 1930, in the message to Congress of December 1938 and 1939, he began to draw attention of the Americans to the war in Europe, coming war in Europe. And in 1939, in July, he began to make plans to enter the war. Now, there are two reasons so far, the political and the economic. Others. Roosevelt had always intended to take over the government as a dictator. This was the philosophy of the New Deal. But he hadn't been able to do it because the purge had backfired badly on him. He intended to do it through the control of the Supreme Court. And when these people broke that up, then he turned on these leading senators. But from that moment on, he was done. Now, I did a great deal of work in the Roosevelt correspondence and in other sources. And Roosevelt realized that the key to getting into World War II was to get the Japanese to attack. And somehow or other, Beard got a hold of part of this, and he set me to wondering. I don't know how he did, don't ask me. And when I was with the One Man Power Commission, I found some memos which Roosevelt had set up. He's not only set up the One Man Power Commission, but he issued a directive through that commission in 1942 March that the government would take over all the railroads and all the other industries in the country when the opportunity developed. And so in 1943, on March 11th, he issued a directive. And now this is in the congressional record. Using the One Man Power Commission and another commission under his uncle Frederick Delano, the War Resources Board, to take over every industry doing work with the government, including the ships, the railroads, the buses, the trucks, the telephone, telegraph, and at that time radio, and he spelled aluminum, a lot of other things. And he sent the message to Congress, but what had happened in the meantime, the Senate had appointed a committee for post-war reconstruction, and they gave the chairmanship to Senator George. And I had to be in St. George's office. This was really funny. When after that directive was sent out, and I said to him, "Did you ever get that? What are you going to do about it?" He said, "He had a great big old fashioned desk with hundreds of cubby holes in it." And he said, "You see that cubby hole up there?" I said, "Yes, but I don't see anything." He said, "You couldn't notice it, but it's in there." And he said, "It isn't going to come out." And it never came, never saw the light of day. But the content was known. And I, in 1944, Roosevelt sent to Congress a worker fight bill. And I, a worker fight. And the War Manpower Commission was supposed to handle it. And the worker fight bill provides all girls from 18 to 36 who were not mothers or mothers of children at 5 years of age under would be drafted. All men 18 to 36 would be drafted for military purposes, and all men not other all men 18 to 65 who are not in a certified war industry, certified by the area directors of the War Manpower Board, would be drafted. We were given orders that if a man got sick, he'd be drafted unless he could produce something from his physician that he couldn't fight. And if he tried to change a job, we were supposed to block him, telling him he couldn't change jobs. In other words, if you were in a war industry and wanted to go work for making chocolate candy, you couldn't do it. And so on, so on, so on. That was full of that stuff. And it was obviously, I got very much disturbed by the bill, because at the same time, the Paul McNutt in Washington sent out a directive that we were to tell every minister within our jurisdiction to preach a sermon on war needs. And I refused to do it. I told my boss, I said, at no time can the state tell the church what to do. I also said that I had a hard time finding that message in the scriptures, and I wasn't about to tell pastors to preach on texts that were not in scripture, and he couldn't find it, and so on. But Paul McNutt was too drunk to know the difference. That didn't make me too popular with my immediate superior, because I flat refused to do it. And I told my people, my assistant, not to do it, and we didn't do it. We covered the whole Shenandoah Valley, so it wasn't done. And I was highly unpopular. But through Senator Russell, I got a hold of the hearing, which on the bill. And this was almost funny. This was 1944, and they summoned General Marshall, and then they summoned the head of the air at the Independent Air Force. They asked the general in charge of the Air Force. I'll never forget this. He said, "Did you back this bill from War Manpower for the Navy, Army Air Corps?" He said, "Indeed, we didn't. We're very particular when we get in the Air Corps." I said, "We don't need those men. We don't want them." He said, "Well, did you support the president?" He said, and the admiral got real mad, or the general got real mad. Oh, it's Arnold, Hap Arnold. He got real nasty, and he said, "We did not." And Senator Russell said, "Well, I want to find out who did." He said, "I believe you." So they got the admiral, the Navy, and the admiral of the Navy got very huffy and said, "We don't need those men. In fact, we don't want them." Period. And he said, "I see your point." And so they got the general of the army, not Eisenhower, but thought, he said, "We got more men now that we can handle. We got more men now we need. Why would we have this bill?" He said, "We had nothing to do with it." And then he called back Hap Arnold, and he said, "Hap," they were on good terms. He said, "Who did?" And Hap said, "Do you really want to know?" And he said, "Yeah." He said, "The administration." And then Arnold let the cat out of the bag. He said, "Why?" And he said, "This bill is designed to control the American people after war." And Russell said, "Thank you." And the bill died. Now, the thing was saved because of these men in the Senate. And they weren't about to do it, you see. and they didn't care too much by that time what Roosevelt thought. Now, there was another reason for it. The war was to be used to, well, that was the third reason. The war was to be used to expand governmental power. And Roosevelt's message are very clear at that point. Don't think I'm dreaming this up. But there's another point involved. And it was this. It was to save Russia. The war was for to benefit Russia. Now, in fact, it's a pretty strong statement. There's abundant proof for it. The final result of any proof would be the Yalta Agreement, from which we're now suffering in regard to Poland. But in 1942, Roosevelt sent Wendell Willkie to Russia. Now, Willkie had been defeated in 1940 presidential race, but Willkie called Roosevelt a liar in that campaign. If you go back in time, it's funny. At Life magazine, Time, Life, and Newsweek, Roosevelt would go to some place and call Wendell Willkie a liar. Wendell Willkie would go to some place like Roosevelt's a liar. And of course, they're both lying. And in that sense, they're both telling the truth. But Wendell Willkie got more votes in losing than any Republican had gotten in winning, you see. And he was a very dangerous competitor. As a matter of fact, during the campaign, Secretary of State Cordell Hull went to Roosevelt and said, I'm resigning from the State Department. And Roosevelt said, why? He said, because when the election's over, you won't need me, because you won't be here either. And Hull, never too friendly to Roosevelt, was very blunt. And, well, Roosevelt won, but he decided he would make use of Wendell Willkie. He recognized the kindred spirit. And so he sent him on a visit to Stalin. And Wendell Willkie came back and wrote a book called One World. And they made it in a movie very obligingly, because Wendell Willkie sold the stuff. But there was a man who was, he was on a first ambassador to Russia by name of Bill Bullitt. And he had been virtually a pro-communist. He came from a very, very, very prominent Bullitt family. Overeducated, stuff-shaped, and, you know, intellectually liberal. But he went to Russia as our ambassador. And in 1937, Mr. Stalin suggested Mr. Bullitt might be happy elsewhere, but they weren't happy with him. He had turned against communism very violently. And so Mr. Roosevelt sent Mr. Bill Bullitt to Paris. Well, Mr. Bullitt didn't like the French, and anybody liked the Russians. And he wrote some very strong notes about the French government going totalitarian, which he didn't approve of one little bit. And so finally, they had to call him back from Paris. But by this time, Bullitt was a thoroughgoing conservative, and nobody would listen to him. But Bullitt was on to Roosevelt. And in 1943, Bullitt went to Roosevelt. Well, in 1941, Roosevelt extended Lend-Lease to Russia after the June attack by Hitler, and opened it up, and he sent Lend-Lease to Russia, and he had had a conference with Stalin, and in proposing the final post-war settlement. And Bullitt got terribly alarmed and went to Roosevelt and told him what was going to happen if he pursued this policy. And he gave him a first-class description of what the Russians were like. I have the text at home. Bullitt. And then Roosevelt replied and answered the book. He said, Bill, you're a great guy. I like you. I know that you have fine intentions. But he said, Harry Hopkins told me that you're wrong. He said that Mr. Stalin's a very friendly person and only wants peace. And so he would not listen to Bill Bullitt. And Hopkins, I might add, was a communist. He's a thorough devotee of a man which I'll mention later here in this book. And he had his own private quarters in the fourth floor of the White House. Now, I hate to say this because I don't have the proof, but it was commonly believed in Washington circles in which I moved that he was a homosexual and that he was there to service the homosexuals in the administration. This is one of the problems that Hull had. Hull was a straight shooter, but the State Department was full of homosexuals. And
it still is.
It still is. and the good men that have a hard time. And now I can't prove that, but that is,
you know, it just dawned to me, this is going to be a 2D show on those films coming this week.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, the Saul Brain, the worst traitor in American history. Yeah. It drips. It drips with honey. Well, I'm not telling you rumor. I've seen these documents. When I was with the War Man Power Commission, we'd get a whole lot of stuff, which we were supposed to do, and which I refused to do. And finally, when I told you I want to be transferred, they did turn me after a big hoopla. And then I saw worse stuff than I ever saw with the War Man Power Commission. In 1941, in August, Roosevelt went on the famous Atlantic cruise with Churchill on a British battleship off Newfoundland. Secret, nobody in Washington knew where he was. They drafted the Atlantic Charter of 8 points, which was a dead giveaway that we were going to go to war, because it set down the article of peace, which would be at the end of the war. And no nation under international law can demand articles of peace unless it's been a participant to the belligerency. It was a dead giveaway, but the American people didn't know. But at that time, Roosevelt and Churchill had secret conferences, at which they drew up two plans. One of them known as the ABD plan, the other the ABC plan. And both of these plans looked toward getting us into war by means of Japan. The ABD plan did not include China. The ABC plan included the possible participation of Chiang Kai-shek in China. Now, why was this held in August 1941? The answer is very simple, and the documents stated. When Hitler invaded Russia in 1941, in June 1941, the leaders of the world knew that the real purpose of the war had come about and that England was safe. Now, the ABC and ABD plans had been first discussed in January 1941, but they had been held in abeyance until the attack came off. 41. I'm going to say in January, I'm not sure of the year. Harry will remember this. There was a big newspaper headline that Rudolf Hess had gotten lost and had landed in Edinburgh, and that he was held in protective custody. Well, Rudolf Hess was Hitler's ambassador to Great Britain, extraordinary plenipotentiary. The British had turned on the searchlights to receive the plane at the Edinburgh airfield. They had been told not to shoot the plane that the Air Force had, and they were waiting. They had the Royal Scots, the famous train, waiting there to take Hess to London to see Churchill. This is all documented. He got to London and said, "Now Hitler wants to tell you about the invasion. Secondly, he wants to restore the Anglo-German anti-Russian pact of August 1938. In August 1938, Chamberlain and Hitler signed a secret agreement that if Germany had trouble with Russia, England would come to Germany's aid to attack Russia. Now, I have the text of that treaty. This was hush-hush. Now, this is a very important part about when Hitler, what had happened was that Stalin had sent a memorandum to Hitler saying, if you will let me have Finland, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Hungary, Poland, Czechoslovakia, Bulgaria, Romania, and European Turkey, I will let you attack France without hindrance. And Hitler hit the panic button. And he sent the whole kit and caboodle to Roosevelt. He was scared. He sent to Chamberlain. And don't you think Hitler wasn't scared? The doctors proved he was scared out of his wits. And so Chamberlain hit the panic button. And they had a secret conference in 1938, and they signed the Anglo-German Anti-Russian Pact. Now, before Chamberlain signed it, he let Roosevelt know what was going on. And Roosevelt was caught. And when Hitler went into Czechoslovakia, he issued long letters about the violent crime and so forth and so on and so on, but he was caught because you may remember in 1938 Chamberlain went to Munich on September 28th and agreed to the takeover. Now, Roosevelt had agreed to let Chamberlain go ahead and sign the Anglo-German Pact.
Was this the basis of
the
statement, peace in our time?
Yes. We came back and said we had bought peace in our time to the British people. Well, he thought he had. But you see, then on September 1st, Hitler went to Poland. But what a lot of people don't know or have forgotten is that Russia went to Poland.
Yes,
at the same time. So, that you see, Hitler had known in 1938, I think it was. Well, yes, the time this big scare that Hitler was, that Russia was going to go into Poland. And so Hitler went to Poland to defend Germany against the Russian advance. And Chamberlain knew this, Roosevelt knew it. And so Roosevelt publicly said one thing and tore into Chamberlain. He called the infamous agreement of September 1938, while at the same time he had approved it secretly to Chamberlain. Now those documents are in a now published by him called Roosevelt Roosevelt's Diplomatic Documents, I think it's called 1933 to 1941, might be 1940, but they have been published, but the public never sees them. So Roosevelt double-crossed Chamberlain by secretly agreeing to it and publicly denouncing Chamberlain. Now, all this goes into the point that what Bullitt said was correct, but Harry Huckins had captivated Roosevelt's mind. So at the end of 43, they signed the Tehran and the Cairo Agreement, which set the stage for Yalta and for the opening up the Second Front. You see,
the British and French and only double-crossed Hitler in the
They did. Hitler, they did.
But he was right. Martin went to the Russians and told not to expect him to
see, Chamberlain finally double-crossed Hitler. And that was done at the instigation of Roosevelt. It's not as intricate as it sounds once you get the key to things. Roosevelt consistently worked to help Stalin against Hitler and to extend the Foreign Aid Bill of March 1941, the Lend-Lease Act, apply it to Russia.
That whole concept of no enemy to the left, which they seem to have. We
sucked
right on down to Vietnam.
Sure, and today, this is an old syndrome repeating itself. I should get in the text, but it, in a real sense, this came out of here. And in 1944, and this was in the paper, Thomas Dewey found out about Pearl Harbor, because at the Atlantic Charter, they had agreed to get the United States into war through Japan. And when the Pearl Harbor investigation was held, and finally, in 1944 and 45, General Marshall was brought on the witness stand by Senator Russell, who was chairman of the Senate Military Committee, and he finally admitted that Japan was inveigled in firing the first shot. Inveigled. Now, how they do it? General Marshall. This is in the reports of the Senate Committee on Military Affairs in the secret session involving Pearl Harbor. They are partially see, the Pearl Harbor report is a little juicy document of 10 million words and 10,000 pages. And they had been revealing parts of it, partly because of expense and partly because to protect the name of Franklin Roosevelt even yet. In 1943, Roosevelt advocated carving up, or 44 at the Quebec Conference, carving up Germany into five pastoral states in order to weaken. And Henry Morgenthau, the Secretary of Treasury, was right behind it. Roger Hiss and Alger Hiss in this country, and Whitaker Chambers, and all that group of the State Department programs were behind carving up Germany to make it as easy as play to Russia. Well, Secretary of State Hull protested at this Quebec Conference. He protested. And so finally, in December 1944, he was reading in his Washington apartment, the Washington Post, and he turned to his wife and said, "Am I sick?" And his wife said, "Not that I know of." She said, "What makes you ask?" And he said, "Well," he said, "the Washington Post has just announced that because of my illness, I am resigning as Secretary of State."
That's how he found out?
Uh-huh. That's how he found out. He didn't know he was sick. Poor man. Of course, he outlived Roosevelt by 12 years, so, I mean, he couldn't have been too sick.
Well, back at Pearl Harbor, did the United States leave Pearl Harbor as a stand-up?
I'm coming to that. That's the point.
Well, let me ask you. You did have the Japanese militancy in the Far East, right?
Yes, you did. Okay. Now,
you had a
yes, but that's the point. But he's got a good point. Now, at the Atlantic Conference, Britain was willing to have Japan go to war because the danger of Britain was over because of the German invasion of Russia. At the Atlantic Conference, they agreed that we would inveigle Japan to go into war. Now, the point is that at that conference, which was a secret conference, somehow or other, Prince Konoya found out about it. Now, Konoya was a civilian prime minister of Japan, a nobleman of the first class. He was a great friend of Secretary of Ambassador Joseph C. Group, whom Charlie McElwain knows down in Pensacola, knows very well. The missionary from Joseph C. Grew, he went to Grew and asked him if he could have a meeting with President Roosevelt. And Grew said, "Yes, I'll be glad to, but why?" And then he told Grew about the Atlantic Charter meeting. and Grew was totally astounded, but anyway, he said, Grew had one weakness. He wrote most magnificent English. He was the old school trained, Harvard, Yale trained, to write perfect English in the old days. He'd gone to the State Department in 1904. He knew what he was doing. And when he went there, I think I've told you, that when he presented his credentials, Konoya had about five or six interpreters there to ready to interpret his English. And he spoke perfect Japanese, and old Konoya's mouth went wide open. I mean, to have an American ambassador speak Japanese was more than they could take. They weren't used to that kind of ambassador, and they became fast friends. And so Kanoya felt perfectly free to go to him, and Gru said, I will arrange it. But Gru wrote a long letter in which he said, in essence, it was 5,000 words, I can't repeat all of it. He said, this is a most unusual form for a Japanese prime minister to offer to go to any place you name, Mr. President, to have a conference of all the outstanding difficulties with Japan. But Gru knew the situation. He said, Mr. President, you have the opportunity to make peace. But if you refuse to do so, within a month, Kanoya will fall and the militarists will take over Tojo and Togo.
Now, what year was
this? This was August 1941. Unfortunately, and unknown to Gru, Gru told Roosevelt exactly what not to do and or what to how to bring war.
Kind of like Balaam and
Balak. Exactly right. Now, I talked to Dr. McElwain about this because he knew Gru well, very well. I don't know if he told you this or not. I spent one day in Tuscola, and he, when he found out I knew about this, he just reveled in. We had a marvelous time. Gru was an old-fashioned, old-school, evangelical, conservative, Orthodox Episcopalian to whom the prayer book and Sermon on the Mount were only next to the Bible. He was a gentleman, and he was beloved by Kanoya. He was loved by the emperor. I think I told you, maybe I didn't, that when Christmas came, 1940, when he was in house arrest, that they sent this huge Christmas basket to him. And he was awakened early in the morning, and the house was guarded, of course, and he heard this noise at the front door. He went down, and he found this huge basket, took out all the turkey and all the stuff and all everything, the bottom, a note. So sorry, Pearl Harbor, your friend Hirohito. But you see, Hirohito did not know about Pearl Harbor. This is why Gru and MacArthur fought so hard to save the emperor. He was not a war criminal. He knew nothing about it. In fact, he had been ousted by the military. Kanoya fell 2 weeks later after Gru sent that note. Because Roosevelt said, no, I can't have a meeting with Kanoya until we settle all the problems. But Kanoya wanted to have a meeting with Roosevelt to settle the problems. But Kanoya said to Mr. Gru, he said, Roosevelt settles problems with England and with France. They say he won't come to me. And when, of course, that ended Kanoya. Kanoya later committed suicide. He was so frustrated by the whole deal. Now, from that time on, when the military took over, it was just a question of time. In November, Japan sent what was called the last-ditch peace offer. And by this time, of course, Hull was up in arms. Well, as a matter of fact, he was out. He'd been out late into 44. Well, he was still here then, but he was furious. They didn't know what to do because Roosevelt told him to answer it in a way which would irritate the Japanese, and he did. He carried out the president's demands. He had been fired hand. This was in November 41, November 26. But before that happened, the Japanese had sent over Kurusu to help Nomura. The two aces of the Japanese diplomatic staff. Nomura had been served by Kanoya. He was Japanese born. He'd gone to Yale to learn his diplomacy. He'd married an American girl and spoke English fluently. And as the Japanese overlord, warlord felt, it was a little too friendly to the United States. So they sent over Kurusu, quote, to unquote, to help him. And Kurusu was one of their adults, but Nomura was the leader of the diplomatic group. But you see, they didn't know. Japan began to send coded messages to Kurusu and to Nomura, but they did not tell him about Pearl Harbor. A friend of mine by the name of Bucky Walters in Salisbury was one of the coding people in the War Department, who was personally taking the decoded messages to Roosevelt. he still lives in Solvent. So this the messages were sent, and on December 3rd, which was a Wednesday.
What do you mean the United States had broken the code?
Yes. We had broken the Japanese code, and it was known as the Code of the Four Winds. And on December 3rd, Roosevelt had a war meeting with his war cabinet. Marshall, Nimitz, Secretary of Agriculture Wallace, Harry Hopkins, Bullitt wasn't there, and some of the others weren't there who were not involved in the deal. And I think it was Marshall said, but Mr. President, this is war. And Roosevelt said, we are at war. We had already been at war. And so from then on, what Roosevelt did was to send back an answer which they knew was unacceptable to the Japanese. But Nomura and Kurusa did not know this, because Nomura and Kurusa went to the White House on December the 7th in good faith to have the final discussions with Secretary Hall. But in the meantime, Secretary Hall had found out from the decoding people that the attack was to take place at 7:30 Hawaii time.
Moving Tora, did you see that? Was it pretty close to the wedge?
I didn't see it.
It's pretty much portrayed the secret event.
I have a friend, Lee Hill, in Salisbury, who's a lieutenant of police, who was at Pearl Harbor. And some of the details I got from him, not the diplomatic, but I mean what actually took place, he was there. And he's a very fine Christian gentleman, a deacon of the Baptist Church. And Hall was forced to postpone the meeting with Nomura and Kurusu until the attack had taken place. So the final thing was that Japan was to be used as a lever to get into the war to help Great Britain. And also to, by that time, if you remember, the danger to England was past. Hitler was fully engaged in the war with Russia. There were desultory attacks on England just to keep them happy but busy, but not. The great blitzes had long since passed over. And as a result, Yalta took place, in which Roosevelt gave the control of Manchuria, China, to Russia, the control of Port Arthur to Russia, and the Pescador Islands and the Kuril Islands, which had been Japanese, they gave over to Russia. And they handed Outer Mongolia over to Russia. And in so doing, they gave the control of China over to Russia. Everybody knew that. And they gave Yugoslavia, Romania, Bulgaria, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, East Germany, Estonia, Latvia, Poland, Lithuania, over to Russia. Now that is known as the heartland of Europe. In that, which you'd ask for from Hitler, Hitler wouldn't give it to him. Now, I have to go on, but that's...
Did Roosevelt know, or did he foresee the slaughter that would take place at Pearl Harbor, or was he just thinking that it was just an attack?
No. They didn't think it would be so bad. But they had... the General Kimmel, Admiral Kimmel, and General Short had removed from their command the scouting planes, and the result was, they were shorthanded, and they did not know. This is almost laughable. When the War Department found out about the that things were bad. Because, see, the War Department was not in control, Roosevelt was, through his own agents. They sent, by Western Union, a message to tell the War Department, the General Short, that things were bad. But they didn't even use the private lines, and the Navy Department sent the same type of message to Admiral Kimmel. Now, when Pearl Harbor took place, everybody said Kimmel chartered traitors. And as you know in this service, you cannot remove a man from his grade. You cannot court-martial a man without a trial. And the Navy and the Army were hard put to it. Popular uproar was against Kimmel Chart was tremendous. But they didn't dare hold court-martial because they'd have to have all the records and all the truth would come out. So the Navy had complete faith in Kimmel. They put him in charge of the Norfolk Naval Base, which is the largest on the eastern coast. And they sent General Short to the Panama City, Florida Air Base. And it was same rank. And of course, as I think maybe I told some of you, Kimmel at the Portsmouth with Norfolk would go up to Washington and he'd bang on the desk in Russell's office and say, "I want to be court-martialed. I demand to be court-martialed." And Short, who was much more vitriolic than Kimmel, would leave Panama City and fly up to Washington and kick the door up and say, "I want to be court-martialed. I demand to be court-martialed. Court-martial me tomorrow." So that means that sort of thing. And then he stomped out and banged the door again and showed he's mad at everybody. But you see, they had strict orders not to court-martial him. Yeah, see, Russell told me, he said, what the problem was that Russell couldn't court-martial him because they'd wrecked the cost of administration to do it, you see. And secondly, they couldn't get the documents. They were locked up. And Russell's in a hard time. But finally, in the election in 1944, well, first of all, the Army and Navy had inquiries in which they came to the amazing conclusion that somebody was at fault, but Kimmel and Short weren't. They did admit that Pearl Harbor happened. Roosevelt, in order to whitewash thing, had a commission appointed by Justice Roberts, Supreme Court. Well, Roberts said, yes, Pearl Harbor did happen. I mean, you know, it's history. And he said, somebody's at fault. And he said he thought that perhaps Kimmel and Short hadn't been informed enough. But it was all nice and you know, nice legal language. So when it was all over, you didn't know what he said. And it didn't indict anybody. And so, but in the meantime, Kimmel and Short were being booed and hissed in the public eye. They were regarded as traitors. And the Navy and the Army didn't dare tell the people that they hadn't even reduced them in rank, but they had given them important posts at Panama City and Norfolk, Virginia. But the public didn't know that, you see. And Kimmel was getting mad. Short probably died of a heart attack. He got so mad. But Kimmel was made of sterner stuff. And he finally wrote a book called The Story of Pearl Harbor by Rear Admiral Husband E. Kimmel. They tried to squelch it, but they couldn't.
So all this stuff that took place with Nixon and the Watergate, that's just commonplace. It's just that they found out.
It was peanuts. I mean, it's now known that Roosevelt had a whole tape service in his office.
I heard something from that tape the other day.
Yeah.
And one of the things was, you know, he was politically astute, and you know that.
They didn't. Well, that's the story of the of.
That was one of the places I think you're talking about.
Probably was.
Do you think that say by the turn of this century, that Roosevelt was going to be recognized for what he was?
Yes, I do. Because more and more historians are coming out, more and more materials being found, and in 1944 Dewey found out about it and was going to use it in the campaign to defeat Roosevelt, and Roosevelt went to him and bade him not to do it. Now this was in the headlines of the paper 2 or 3 months ago, and asked Dewey not to do it. That would wreck the public confidence in the government, which was true. And Dewey, thinking I would decide not to do it. And you may remember he came very close to defeating Roosevelt, it was, but he didn't. He lost, but he retired from the field with honor. Much more honor than people gave him, and not as much honor as he deserved.
Well, Dr. Hyde is writing this book called The Story of Pearl Harbor.
It's a tremendous indictment of Roosevelt. It's based upon husband Admiral Kimmel. It's based upon his own official copies of all the messages which he received and sent as Commander-in-Chief at Pearl Harbor, along with appropriate parts of the Pearl Harbor report, which I've always suspected he got from Senator Russell, but I can't prove a word I say. Russell was very sympathetic to him. But you see, to hold a court-martial required that you have all the documents, he has the defense, he has legal counsel, right counsel, and they couldn't afford to have that go public. Because they would have to be found guilty, innocent. And if you found the commander-in-chief innocent in Pearl Harbor, then the commander-in-chief in Washington is guilty. Right? Yeah. The American people were so deceived at Pearl Harbor. And when they announced Yalta and MacArthur, did you ever know a John King, aide-de-camp to General MacArthur? He's later one of my students. He told me a great deal about the reception of MacArthur in Japan. And what had gone on before. When Joseph C. Group came back on the Grips home, along with Dr. McElwain, Hall, before he left office, made him Undersecretary of State. And in January 1945, Group wrote a long memorandum to Mr. Roosevelt on what not to do and what to do, notably to save the emperor at all costs, and what not to do in regard to Russia. And Roosevelt did exactly opposite. And in April 1945, MacArthur committed a fatal mistake by leaving a long memorandum to Roosevelt, in which he pointed out that they should go on and attack Germany. Russia, and end the Russian menace. In which he fully supported the invasion of Russia, among other things. There's a long memorandum in typical MacArthur terms, where it grew with that lovely 1900 beautiful Victorian English, where your ambassador would recommend the following, in style. It was beautifully written. He could write the most beautiful language and get more words into one paragraph in the button. He couldn't even say good morning without having a paragraph attached. No. No, I don't know. Let's have a little break now. I'll get down to some serious words with you. But this doesn't hurt your nose once in a while.